You have found the Business Broker Growth Show with your host, Jason Cutter. This is the podcast for brokers who are ready to stop hoping for deals and start growing their pipeline. Our goal is to bring you strategies, stories, and insights that will be a catalyst to move you quickly from transactional deal makers to trusted advisors. Time for Business Broker Growth.
Hey everybody, Jason here with a special guest episode. I'm excited today. I've got with me John Wall. He's the Director of Acquisition Lending at Live Oak Bank. This is going to be fun. We're going to talk about lending. We're going to talk about brokers and buyers and sellers and everything around that. John, welcome to the Business Broker Growth Show.
Jason, thanks a lot. I am too excited to be part of this today and see where it takes us.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. It's interesting too. And I've had a few people on the show who are not business brokers so far, like in the evolution of the show. And when I first started the podcast, my vision and intention was with business brokers for business brokers, right? And that was the whole goal of what I did. And I shortly realized that in recording a few episodes in that there's so much more to it and there's so much more value, and that fundamentally the business transaction, you could call business brokerage, but like M&A intermediary and all of that whole world has a huge awareness and an education problem where there's just not enough information. A lot of people are kind of playing different games or not playing the right game or no game at all. And so I realized, like, who can I talk to that just helps everybody and anybody? And you as an SBA lender on that side typically work with buyers, but where does that matter for sellers? And so let's start off just, you know, brief intro, because I know you've been doing this for quite some time, is a little bit of background for you and how your evolution resulted with SBA lending.
Yeah, I'll give you as long a version if you want. But, you know, one of those kids that looked around when I was younger and I was like, you know, it'd be great to wear a suit and carry a briefcase. I mean, that was cool back when I was young. You know, in high school, you see that and it was popular, and maybe a three-piece vest if I was really successful in what I did. So finance degree from University of Colorado Boulder, started my career in personal banking. Realized that there was much more that I think I could provide and I could get out of my finance background. And so in 2005, started SBA financing, spent some time, you know, did everything prior to that, got Series 7 license, Series 63, was in private banking, that sort of thing. But SBA was kind of this, you know, under the carpet financing division. I worked for a big bank, worked for Wells Fargo for over 17 years. And it was just a really unique, common sense approach, still division within a larger organization. So spent 17 years working for them. As with a lot of companies, things change, but the education and what you take away from that opportunity is what helps you grow and what helps you educate others around you. And then in 2018, Live Oak Bank created a industry agnostic acquisition division, of which I was one of the first individuals to come over and help build that team, and have been building it ever since, to the point of where we now have 45 plus industry agnostic lenders coupled with, you know, 100 industry dedicated lenders and service buyers, help borrowers and brokers all throughout the country. So it's kind of been a unique evolution, one that I have learned a ton along, and I'm lucky to be able to share that with your listeners and those folks that I interact with every day, either be part of my team or prospective borrowers.
It's funny because at first when you were talking about growing up, I thought you were kidding, because like there's a lot of people who are like, I didn't dream of growing up into getting into this role, but it's fascinating and funny to think that you did. And then I was just picturing you as a kid walking around, but of course I'm picturing you, but just smaller.
Yeah. So like, I still have three piece suits and suspenders in my closet. And, you know, I knew I didn't want to be a CPA or somebody that just sits behind the desk punching numbers. I had to be in front of people, had to have that social need to be able to interact with either borrowers, brokers, sellers. So I still put on the dress shirt even when I'm not on your podcast. So
yeah. What super side note, because now I'm curious. when you were growing up, when you got into that mode, when you realized you want to do something in the finance world, was there like, did you have any entrepreneurial ventures? Were you like loaning money to people? Were you, you know, doing any trading?
Like a lot of kids, entrepreneur about the kid with the mower in the neighborhood. So, I mean, I was slinging yard work from a very early age, even before my professional career. You know, I worked in a restaurant. I worked in retail, a ski shop where I found my passion for skiing. And so, of which, as a side note, I think everybody out there should work in certain industries, restaurant being one of them, 100%. Retail being another one, and labor being the other one. So that's my side note for people that are starting off.
Yeah, I don't think about the labor side, but I think that's a good one to add to my list, because my list is always, everyone should have to work in food service, retail, or a call center. And then we can add manual labor to that as well. Because then it just makes you appreciate it better instead of like, you know, not understanding it. I think that's important. So let's talk about a term that you mentioned that I haven't heard, but it's just really because I just don't, you know, I'm not a part of the SBA world, is the industry agnostic. Like, I know what that means. Obviously, it's not tied to an industry, but I'm guessing generally in the banking world, business financing, you have an industry, you only know that industry, and you deal with that industry so that you know how to lend safely. Is that how it
generally
works?
And so in 2008, when Live Oak was founded, they went and got their charter with the business plan of, we are only going to lend in one industry. And that original industry was veterinarians. You know, Live Oak was known as the puppy bank when we were first founded. And then as we grew, we added additional industries that we had individuals that were specialists in. We also knew statistically that these loans had lower default rates. You know, the SBA is great. They have the Freedom of Information Act, where you can go back to all the loans and figure out all that data points. And so Live Oak grew from lending in one vertical to now we have over 35 verticals where we have dedicated individuals that are at those trade shows, that are, you know, mingling with people in those specific industries, where the difference of our team, and which was kind of new to Live Oak in 2018, was, let's take the expertise of people that have been doing this for 15, 20 years of business acquisition financing, and let them build a team where they specialize in just business acquisition amongst all industry, not some of these small and not some of these dedicated industries. So, you know, our team probably does 80% of their total volume in business acquisition, in change of ownership, in partner buyouts. So we're specialists in the fact that we specialize in change of ownership, but we're agnostic with the industries that we will lend and finance within.
Yeah, and it's interesting to think about, especially if I correlate that to others, like let's say business brokers who might be listening to this, which is always that kind of debate or conversation around being a specialist in an industry or a generalist. Now, the generalists still usually have some parameters, whether it's regional or, you know, deal size, business size, that kind of thing. But like getting to know one industry versus being able to apply it. So that's fascinating. I will say, early in my business life, I didn't know very much about anything out there. And I remember meeting this guy where his job was, he worked for, might've been Wells Fargo, and he was a commercial appraiser, and his niche was heavy equipment and airplanes. He just traveled around the country appraising heavy equipment and airplanes. And I was like, that's the wildest niche. And thinking about lending to that, like, I couldn't fathom it at the time.
Yeah. I mean, so our group doesn't do startups, you know, doesn't do standalone lines of credit. I mean, there are lenders out there. I mean, Wells was a good example of a very, you know, generalist, doing everything for everyone type thing. And so our niche is just helps us, I think, get from A to Z a little bit better, knowing what you're going to encounter along the road.
Got it. So we've got, if I'm doing some math here, you got 21 years in SBA and what, 11 years with Live Oak specifically. And when you look at that, what what are some big changes that jump out in this timeline with the SBA, like in the SBA lending world since you started?
Yeah, I mean, SBA, when I got involved in it, had a cap of $2 million, if I can remember that far back. So yeah, I've been with Live Oak for 8 years, since 2018. And I remember, so $2 million, there was an increase to the $2 million cap of financing. And that went on for a number of years. And then SBA came out and said, well, the maximum financing for intangible is $500,000. Anything above that has to be fully secured. So, I mean, that was obviously like, well, how do you manage that when most of these businesses, almost all of them, have a significant amount of intangible assets? So making it through that part, you pivot. You know, you look at real estate transactions. So there was a lot of pivoting going on during then. They came out of that, went back to the $2 million. And then a number of years ago, increased the SBA limit to $5 million. And that was great, but not every bank rode that ride to the $5 million when it comes to financing, you know, intangible assets up to $5 million. So banks can always be within the constraints of SBA financing and be more conservative with their own bank policy. They just can't be outside of the four corners of the standard operating procedure. So I think that has been, you know, when you look at the program as a whole, has been some of the bigger changes that have occurred in it. One of the news, not news type of things is the recent decoupling of the SBA 7A program from the 504 program. A lot of listeners may not be familiar with the 504 program, which is specifically dedicated for real estate and very long-term assets, you know, think CNC machines, things like that, where a bank partners with a community development company and there's multiple loans involved and there's actually capital from the CDC that issues debenture. What has previously happened is the amount of total dollars available was combined between those two programs. Now they took them apart. So you could have a $5 million 7A loan and you could still have a $5 million 504 debenture for real estate or heavy equipment. So that's, there were ways around that if it was green or if it was a manufacturer. So that is, you know, news and not news, but, you know, we've seen various changes to the fee structure, from waiving fees. We've seen over COVID free money almost where, you know, 6 months of principal and interest was made by the SBA and there was no origination fee. We all survived PPP, which was a really interesting program by the Treasury and the SBA to help small businesses. I think the philosophy behind it was well intended. The amount of fraud and regulation, I think, was tough on that. But, you know, that has been some of the interesting ones. Now, you're seeing changes, amongst, you know, who qualifies for an SBA loan. It used to be that legal permanent residents were eligible for SBA financing, so permanent green card holders. That rule changed back in February to where only U.S. citizens are eligible for SBA financing. So that one has created some challenges for legal permanent residents wanting to buy a business or buy real estate through the SBA program. So been a lot of changes over the last 20 years, you know, from the size of it to fees. A couple of years ago, all of the fintech businesses got involved and were, you know, not really underwriting transactions. So there was smaller loans out there that had a really, really high default rate. And that has kind of the most recent standard operating procedure that came out, eliminated some of that high risk, high default type of financing. So that was a long answer to your question there, but 20 years.
No, that's great. I think it is fascinating. And this is not a paid promotional podcast by Live Oak Bank. You and I even spoke about like trying not to make it sound like this was a commercial for Live Oak Bank, but I'm curious because when I think about what you said, like let's say the limit's $5 million and then banks can choose to be more conservative or they can play to the limits. Are the big traditional bank names that you would think of, are they generally more conservative and go under the limits? And
yeah, let's say like they are going to be
else play more to the limit? Or is it
yeah, I think most of them are going to be more conservative on that. They are a big bank where most of their money is made through other products and services as opposed to SBA financing. You know, our bank, on the other hand, that's primarily all we do. 60% of what all the loans we do are SBA backed. The other 40% are still within a lot of change of ownership, just middle market types of transactions. So, you know, that is one of the big differences that I always encourage borrowers is work with a bank that focuses on SBA financing. You know, not every bank was founded just to do that like we were, but there are other good lenders where SBA financing is a larger part of their overall product mix and their overall revenue driver. So I think that is important to understand. So there are also, you know, you talk about the 5 million, there are a few banks out there that will do and provide either conventional junior lien position or pari passu shared lien position loans for up to another $4 million to help bridge the gap that is kind of no man's land right now above that 5 million with additional financing that is their own bank's capital to help, you know, deals that are maybe up to $12 million in enterprise value. So,
got it. Interesting. So considering who your client is, which is the buyer who's looking for the financing to buy this, how have buyers changed?
I think that's a great question. I think over the last five plus years, you have seen entrepreneurship really be a focus with colleges. Entrepreneurship through acquisition. You've seen the searcher world explode with, you know, the interest among younger generations of buying a business. Historically, the traditional buyer for a business was probably somebody that retired or sold their business, you know, or sold their business and was buying another business, but primarily corporate refugees who, were older and done with the W-2 employment and either wanting to retire or just be their own boss. Now, there is a much younger profile of buyers out there that are either, you know, coming directly from college or going through master's programs with, you know, degrees or emphasis in that acquisition through, entrepreneurship through acquisition mentality and looking at businesses. And, you know, there is a lot more interest in businesses, regardless of what the industry might be, blue collar, white collar, that sort of thing. I think the other piece that we have seen, you know, over the last 3 to 5 years, probably last 3 to 5 years, is that borrowers are coming to the table much more educated than they have in the past. I think the availability of information online, I think the, you know, podcasts like yours are helping to educate individual borrowers out there. And there's, you know, a lot of free education out there. There's a lot more seminars out there. So, you know, borrowers are getting wiser sooner in the process. And I think that's great. I think it's good for the program. They're understanding and asking tough questions early on. They're narrowing down the types of businesses that they are looking for. So borrowers have become more educated. Over the last year, borrowers have taken that one step further with kind of the explosion of AI on where they're going, questions they're asking, how they're finding companies. A lot of folks might be trying to find businesses direct, which never used to happen. Always was we're using business intermediaries and business brokers. So the borrower profile has definitely changed. Even though we still do have the corporate refugee, there is a much younger educated mix of borrowers, which has been good and bad for the program. And the SBA is trying to find the right mix and balance of qualifications for business owners and borrowers.
What are some of the, I don't want to focus on just the bad stuff, but what are some of the bad things that the SBA is trying to maybe regulate around to ensure success?
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of a mix of things out there. The most recent change was that the SBA has now SBA used to only require disclosure of 51% of the ownership. Now the SBA is requiring 100% disclosure of the ownership. So where the equity is coming from, we always would ask that question and know who it was, but now you're having to, you know, drill down to each 1% or greater owner, where if you had, you know, maybe an LP that was funding or an LLP that was funding the equity, now all those LPs within that have to disclose individually. And the rule that is being navigated right now is that if a business goes bad and had those minority investors that were non-operators, that would disqualify them from future SBA financing. There is work being done between the search community and the SBA to say, okay, well, let's look at this on a case by case. So the SBA didn't reverse that requirement or that rule, but has a process set up to allow for those minority owners to appeal the decision of them no longer being eligible for SBA financing. So that's kind of been a unique rule. I think what the SBA has seen is that when there is a lack of transferable or managerial experience, there is a higher increase in default rates and charge-offs within the industry. So how you balance that and how you have the right borrower, you know, that's where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah. And it's really an interesting scenario when you think about it. And I think of this, especially with the corporate refugee world, which is, you know, just because maybe you got to a really good executive level, maybe you're really good within your silo of a business, doesn't mean you know how to run a manufacturing company or whatever it is. Like you could, and you can learn it, but it's not completely transferable just because you did something well over here. There's a lot of aspects to a business. And then I think of the younger, I went to college, I, you know, studied entrepreneurship through acquisition, search funding. I took a course, I'm following a guru. And then like, I think I know how to run a business versus like what it takes, especially to take over somebody's existing business and what's involved. So where are you coming up against, and then how are you handling it for people out there listening to this? The buyers who are coming to you for financing after their online education, the free stuff they're finding on the internet, the courses, the gurus and all those things, and they have these ideas that are not actually valid in the world of SBA. Let's say no money down.
Yeah. So the no money down one, there's still a lot of bad information out there. I'll have borrowers say that a lender still told them, you know, they heard this, this, and this. And that's, again, going back to last year, there were 1,400 lenders that did an SBA loan. The top 10 make up 30% of the total volume. So it is very concentrated. So for those folks, you know, there's the short answer of can't do it now, not eligible, those sort of things. There's the longer answer of can you find a partner? Can you find equity investors? And that equity investor is obviously where some of those traditional search models come from. You know, can you find friends, family, you know, the old, I used to call it the MCI, you know, friends and family. might be a little old for this audience, but you know, can you find it from other sources? It doesn't make you ineligible, or it doesn't make you that we can't approve a loan if it's not your money. We just want to know whose money it is. And then obviously knowing that there is less skin in the game or no skin in the game is the experience piece of it. But, you know, there is no free ride where you can get in with no cash, no equity, nobody's investment. You know, there's some flexibility of meeting the SBA 10% requirement where sellers can help participate in that equity component with a seller note where there's no payments for the entire term of the loan. But most lenders are only entertaining that in certain scenarios where there's direct industry experience or maybe an internal buyer. So, you know, that's kind of how that approach, we are taking that approach on that.
And it makes sense, right? If you're going to basically do no money down, you better be able to deliver on that business and not default.
Yeah, right? I think the other new structure within SBA financing is the partial buy-in. You know, up until 2 years ago, you had to purchase 100% of the company. 2 years ago, they started to allow for this partial buy-in. So it is an alternative structure that is great if somebody maybe doesn't have money and wants to buy in and the company has the right amount of equity structure. It's also great for somebody that doesn't have the right experience, but has a target company where that seller doesn't want to completely exit. They're willing to take a new buyer under their wing and teach them the trade and how operationally to run the company. The caveat with that is that SBA said, great, but Mr. or Mrs. Seller, you've got to guarantee that loan for 2 years. And that came across as really, you know, demanding at first, but I think the market has opened to that more, knowing that the seller is taking the majority of the chips off the table. They can still be active in the business. They can still take a salary for the business, but they can take the next step to handing that business off to that seller. You know, so that was kind of, I think, a great change within the SBA policy to help create that. And it's great for internal buyers or family members or, you know, that mechanic that doesn't have the cash but has the experience and wants to be the next generation of business owners with having that seller take a little bit of the risk as well.
Now, how, I mean, it's observation bias because you obviously deal with the people who actually talk to you, but how many people out there do you think actually know about those kind of options? Let's say the mechanic, the auto shop owner that wants to sell it to the mechanic. Like, is that on their radar?
No, I think it's pretty limited. Yeah. I mean, so obviously, it's limited in the reach that it has, especially if there's not brokers. I mean, so obviously the goal is to try and educate the broker community to know that these are great opportunities where you may be able to help a seller out by looking internally to individuals that previously may not have been eligible or may not have been eligible or had the financial wherewithal to qualify for SBA financing, yet are great buyers because of the experience that you have. So, I mean, that's kind of, I think every lender out there could do more in spreading that word because it is, you know, there's a huge amount of businesses that close every year because they didn't have a succession plan. They didn't know that they could sell it to, you know, their head foreman or that they could sell it to their plant manager or something like that by participating in the transaction.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. Again, that's why in the intro, just talked about the relative challenge that you and the business broker community have, which is awareness and education. Like the buyers, the people putting information out to potential buyers, they're really good at marketing, right? Like they're really good at content, really good at putting things out there. And then buyers, like somebody wants to not work in a job, so they've got a problem they're trying to solve and they know how to solve it. Then I think of business owners who don't know they have a problem they can solve because they think, I built this business, I run it for 20, 30 years, and then I close it down and I go off into the sunset, right? I don't even think of there's an option. So they don't even know that they have a problem to solve, which is, I think, the interesting dynamic with that.
Yeah, I think that that is part of it. And then, you know, the other piece of that is sellers who start the exit process and kind of step away from the company as well. You know, their mindset is retirement bound, not operational from day to day, on keeping their foot on the gas. So that is another thing that I always, when I talk to sellers or I talk to brokers, I was like, you got to remind your seller that the business is the most important thing, and them keeping their foot on the gas and revenues where they're at and relationships with vendors and customers is critically key to the ability of financing a transaction.
If you're listening to this and thinking, I need this level of authority, I just don't have time to build it, that's exactly what Business Broker Growth does for you. Most brokers know that they need consistent content, better positioning, and real digital visibility. They just don't have the bandwidth to create it or the systems to keep it going. That's what we do here. We build that whole thing for you. The content engine, the visibility strategy, and the authority signals, everything we've talked about here on the podcast. So if you want to add impact without adding another full-time job to your plate, go to businessbrokergrowth.com to learn more about what it could look like for your business.
Yeah, and I can imagine what that would do if somebody's revenue is declining, or, you know, things are changing seriously in the business towards the finish line. And then you guys look at updated financials, you and the buyer, and everyone's like, wait a second, this is not the same deal anymore.
Absolutely. I mean, the value is going to be different, and the ability to obtain financing is going to be challenged. And we have seen deals where, you know, companies have really fallen apart in the last 90 days or in the new year, and we didn't have updated financials, and that has prevented financing from moving forward. So to all the sellers listening, please keep focused on your company.
It's like, start the process with the business broker and get them what you need to get them so that they can do their part of like evaluating, listing, and then finding buyers, and then completely forget that you did that and just go back to work.
100%.
Right, like go back to getting it done.
Like your life depends on the next week, month, year of financial performance. Yeah, absolutely.
Just go back to needing that. The challenge is, and I think this happens in many scenarios, someone gets to the point where they want to leave. They want to leave for various reasons, right? Could be they're just burnt out, could be divorce, could be death in the family, could be illness, could be all these reasons. And so then it's these things where it's like they overstayed. When, you know, now it's like, just don't want to be there anymore or can't do it or some other factor. And I think that's always the challenge, is why, you know, I'll say it here. Business, the thing I learned from business brokers is, you know, for many owners that are out there, 2-3 years ahead of time, if you can, just start the process and the planning and making sure everything is in place. And I'm sure from your side, you see that all the time too, where you probably get some crazy financials where you're just like, this doesn't, it's not lining up with what you can lend on.
Yeah, 100%. I couldn't echo your comment more about the more that a seller can plan ahead, even if it's a year or two, you know, helps to increase what the sales price is going to be, helps to have clean financials, all that sort of thing. So yeah, there are, it's detrimental. You know, you talk about the five D's there, or at least you hit on three or four of them. And you see that a lot of, you know, that burnout, divorce, death, or something like that. And they got to sell it. And, you know, those businesses aren't the ones obtaining a premium with buyers. They are distressed and they may not be financeable. You know, there is a, one of my colleagues said this at the conference recently, and that there is a relationship between the broker and the seller and the buyer and the bank. And those may not always be symbiotic on how they operate when, you know, a company doesn't have financials that illustrate repayment capacity or are dependent upon the seller using their company as a personal piggy bank to fund their personal expenses. A good colleague of mine was recently at the IBBA and M&A Source conferences up in Minneapolis, and he has a good saying. He says, you know, there's a relationship between the broker and the seller, and then there is a relationship between the borrower or buyer and the bank, and those are not always symbiotic. Really, the takeaway, what he was trying to say is that, you know, there are not every business that is out there can be financed. And I think most people understand that, but there are a lot of, especially as we were talking, some of these distressed businesses or when sellers make the decision too late to sell the company, it really limits the options that they have. Their only choice may be finding a cash buyer, of which case they're going to want a discount on that premium, on that business enterprise value, or having to carry back a seller note until that business rebounds and then becomes financeable. So statistically, I don't know how many, what percentage businesses listed are able to be financed through SBA. But what I do encourage brokers to do is work with a lender that specializes in acquisition financing to get those businesses pre-qualified, meaning a lender can take a look at them, go through, see what some of the red flags might be, what kind of leverage can be put on it, what a targeted buyer would look like. And that is one of those things that make the process quite a bit more efficient as well.
So you mentioned getting pre-approved, and I know that that's a thing that I've heard many times that's super important for business brokers to do with their, you know, with their clients, with sellers. What is it that you want business brokers to know, wish they knew? I can imagine sometimes brokers have tried it and it didn't go well, maybe it killed a deal, or maybe it wasn't the right lender they tried to get it pre-approved with. Like, so what's the biggest tips or advice you'd have?
One of the biggest tips I'd have is being organized, you know, with the information that a lender is going to need. That's going to include current financials within the last 60 days, you know, profit and loss, and yes, a balance sheet. A balance sheet is not just the cover letter to the P&L statement, but also having comparable financials for that same period prior year is super helpful if there's seasonality to the business and being able to see if they're on track to when it's annualized, having the last 3 years of full federal tax returns. I laugh. Sometimes I see deals where we only get the first page. And that's like reading the first chapter of a 12 chapter book. You really don't know the story. You just know what they're trying to tell you, but you don't know if that's true or not. So the full federal tax returns, you know, understanding the receivables and the payables, the aging is super important. So having those current aging reports that match that balance sheet. Two pieces where that can blow deals up when that information isn't received early enough is a customer concentration report or customer by revenue report to understand, is there customer concentration, which is typically 20% or greater per customer. Knowing if 85% of your revenue comes from one customer, that is extremely risky and a challenge. The other piece is kind of understanding ongoing capital expenditure needs. This one is not focused as much on as lenders would wish it was, you know, because we always need to account for that with any type of business that's being purchased, where there's equipment, hand tools, vehicles, trailers, trucks, that sort of stuff. So having an organized package is great. And really helps to set the whole transaction up for success. We as a lender can pre-qualify that quickly and be able to, you know, ask any questions that we might need to be able to get you marketing material so that you can include that in your file and know that there is some due diligence that goes along with it. There are, you know, different lenders do it different ways. Some people will just give you something and not review the financials. We're going to review the financials. So as a broker, I would want to know how much diligence was and thought was put into that pre-qualification letter, knowing, can you execute? And I think really that's the biggest question that everybody in the transaction wants to know is, can the lender execute? Can that buyer execute with that lender? And we're wanting to try and know if we can execute early on in the process, not to waste anybody's time. So,
yeah. And in your process, then, is there like a, you know, you're producing a pre-approval letter or pre-approval something that says, you know, this has been looked through?
Yeah. I mean, I would change the language just a little bit from pre-approval to pre-qualification, knowing
pre-qualified.
That,
there we go.
Yeah. Yep. Knowing that the business is only part of the total pie. The other piece of that pie is the buyer. And we will do the same thing for buyers. We will ask the tough questions, you know, are you in the divorce? Have you had a bankruptcy? Are you a felon? You know, what's your credit score? Do you have liquidity? Where's the cash coming from? We'll ask all those questions during our buyer pre-qualification process to know that someone that is writing or wanting to get access to confidential information is a worthy recipient of that information, not just a tire kicker that doesn't have, you know, any financial wherewithal or managerial wherewithal to put this transaction together. So yeah, to your point, there's the pre-qualification of the selling side of it. We're happy to assist with that. Then there's the pre-qualification of the buying side of it. And I would encourage, I would discourage brokers from accepting offers from borrowers that have not been pre-qualified or vetted from a lending institution that specializes and knows acquisition financing. So,
yeah, which makes sense. And I'm guessing you're saying that with those very specific words because it happens where somebody is pre-qualified by a lending institution that's not familiar with acquisition financing.
Yeah.
Turns out to not actually be valid or, you know, appropriate.
Yeah, indeed. You do see that where, you know, there wasn't much thought put into the ability to finance this business and they're, you know, losing money in the last, you know, quarter, year to date, and they have an 80% concentration and, you know, and that list goes on and on. So some institutions will put something out there without having thought or completing some due diligence on the actual financeability of that company. So,
yeah, I could see that. Beyond the preparation, the paperwork, the being organized and prepared, are there any other big disconnects that you see between lenders and the brokers being, you know, representing the sellers?
Feels kind of like what you said. It's like two parties that are kind of playing, you know, with the same goal, but not.
Yeah. I mean, obviously we love the relationship with business brokers, even though we represent the borrower at the end of the day. I mean, business brokers and intermediaries are what fuel, you know, our ability to do financing. So I would think, you know, when I thought about this, there are some questions and some discussions that have to be had. The sooner the better. And some of those tend to be around landlords. Can this property get a new lease for a new buyer? And will it match the term of the SBA loan with the initial term and plus options? I've seen deals where we got transactions approved. We were in closing. No one wanted to have that conversation with the landlord until about 2 weeks ahead of time. Come to find out the landlord was not going to renew the seller's lease. It was a location dependent business. They were redeveloping that piece of property. So the whole transaction imploded right then. I think that is one of them. I think the conversation around licensing, you know, I encourage brokers to know very clearly what type of licensing is required for that business to operate. And what the state requires on that. Can it be employee licensed? Can it be owned? Does it have to be owner licensed? You know, how many of those employees might be able to test for the license because they have the required hours? I think that, you know, the service industry right now is very popular. So that is a question that comes up very often. Questions around vendor terms. Is that vendor going to offer terms to our new buyer or are they going to go COD? That is impactful in the structure of the transaction. And we've seen that. And then this last one I know is a delicate one, but allowing the buyer to have conversation with key employees. I understand that that is down the road. Some sellers don't want to tell their employees. We feel that it's important that understanding if there are key employees, what are their goals or what are their short-term goals? What are their long-term goals? Are they going to stick around? We've seen transactions where key employees were planning to retire and they left, and that was a detriment to the company. We've seen transactions where key employees were wanting to have an equity stake in the transaction, weren't aware that the business was sold until afterwards, decided that there was nothing that tied them to the business, no retention or nothing that legally tied them to the business. And so after 6 months, they left. The two of them that were responsible for 60% of the revenue left the business, took a bunch of employees, and that business did not succeed. So those are kind of some of the ones that I would encourage discussions to be had sooner rather than later.
Yeah, it makes sense. I've learned from brokers, there's the non-invasive due diligence, and then there's the invasive due diligence, which is those categories there. It's like things that can be done offsite, separate. Then there's the things, you know, at some later stage that need to be done. I think that's all great. I love the perspective that you have and shared from the lending side, which is, you know, again, representing the buyer, but it's so pivotal because, you know, the percentage of businesses that sell that need financing, that are relying on a buyer using SBA financing instead of like an all cash type of deal. Like, you've just got to account for it. You can't just assume it's all going to work out and go well. You know, there's a lot to it. So let's move on to the next segment, because I'm always curious about this one. This is a fun one for me. Let's talk about the marketing side. So this is technically the broker growth tips. You're on the lender side. You've been doing that for a long time, but you know, at some level, marketing is marketing. You have a fascinating position because you're marketing to the buyers, but then also the brokers who should pre-qualify with you. And so it's like, it's just kind of all over the place for you. So what do you have on your list that you would share as some growth tips?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of those was to, you know, get the business pre-qualified, be organized about the transaction, be able to market that business. I think a great marketing strategy is to market it to competitors, is a low-hanging fruit of available buyers for that business. I understand that indeed has some caveats and challenges to it. But, you know, one thing I didn't mention is, you know, if someone's buying something in the same industry, they can get financing at 100%. And that is probably one of the most unknown facts. So it does make it relatively easy for that type of financing. Some of the other marketing strategies is that, you know, working with others that are part of the transaction, be it seminars, be it other online marketing, you know, lenders are always happy to partner up to try and market with them, to educate buyers, sellers, along with partners such as CPAs and attorneys. Anybody that's part of the deal team is a great resource to try and partner up with on that.
I love it. I think that's great. And I think, you know, where combining forces, especially, again, I've mentioned this now twice so far, is the awareness and the education piece is I think the biggest Achilles heel of the broker intermediary industry. It's most people don't know about it. So the more you can kind of combine and utilize resources out there, I think that's great. And I think it's super important. You know, how about from your side? What's like from the lender side? What have you found works from a marketing perspective?
Being online, you know, with all of these, with where people go to get questions answered, having a presence in AI, I think is important. Having a presence on LinkedIn, having a presence and being interactive with others in the industry, I think is critical for us. You know, there's some secret sauce to it, but I also am a big believer that, you know, in-person meetings of face-to-face is still super valuable. More and more of our referral sources are remote, but there's nothing more than I love hosting a happy hour or going to a Wednesday sales meeting and sitting down across the table with people I want to partner with and helping them, helping to educate them. So still, you know, I travel 80 plus days a year to speak with buyers, brokers, sellers. And so I still think that face-to-face time is super valuable. Even though you can do most of the transactional stuff online today. So everything from AI to shaking hands.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's great. It's always fascinating to me the old things that become new again, and they kind of go out of style and then they come back. People try to automate or, you know, make things very efficient, and then it just comes back to, like, especially right now, the value of impersonal meetings and relationships. At some point, having that in-person interaction, how much that speeds up the trust process and the relationship in general. So I think that's always interesting to watch those kind of cycles. Like, where is handwritten notes going to come back in full steam, as, you know, everything is just so flooded online. You know,
we have a team member that sends 30 plus thank you cards out every month to borrowers, referral sources, trade people. And I still think that is memorable. And that is a differentiator. And I think, you know, I don't think SBA is a commodity. I think there are still specialists, and differentiating your message and how you can deliver, I think, is still really important. So,
I agree. I think because it's not known enough and easily shoppable, versus, like, I was in the mortgage business in the early 2000s, and that was just a straight up commodity. People would call me and say, I checked bankrate.com this morning and here's what they would give me. What can you do? It's like,
yeah,
30-year fix is a 30-year fix, man. Like, it is what it is. Like, there's not, like, you could try to spin it any other way, but a refi is a refi, versus what you're talking about. And even the business brokers, you know, that are listening to this, like, it's, that's not even commoditized because it's not comparable enough, you know.
And I tell people this all the time, you know, yes, rate is a component to the transaction. And we price transactions based off of the quality. But at the end of the day, if it takes you 3 or 4 months longer to work with someone that is 50 basis points cheaper, how much have you lost? What is your opportunity cost? How much have you lost in monthly cash flow and that net income of closing 120 days earlier? I mean, so it, rates are rates, but then math and earnings potential are just that. So,
yeah. For sure. All right. So let's move on to the last portion of the show, because this should be fun for me. It's usually not fun for the guest, but it's the deal that got away. So this is the lessons of the lost deal. I know you've got a lot of them. You've already mentioned a couple where deals, like, exploded, like the one, you know, about the landlord who had not planned on renewing the lease anyway, independent of a transaction. So when you think about this as kind of a cautionary tale to buyers, to sellers, to business brokers, to SBA lenders, you know, if you had to pick one, what comes to mind as that deal that got away lesson?
Yeah. And I would almost, there's probably a handful that I would kind of put into this same bucket of the deals that got away. And that is, you know, it's never over until it's over. And what I have seen over the last 18 months is that emotions control transactions. Good, bad, or indifference, that we have seen sellers and buyers walk away because their gut told them to, or because they weren't, the sellers weren't ready to sell, you know? And so it is important. And why I say that is it's an important to build a relationship with that seller and have a buyer and seller relationship where trust is key. Is what you, the information you're getting accurate? Is the information that you're providing accurate? Because burning that bridge can be very detrimental to the success and likelihood of the deal closing. We've seen more deals where just people change their mind for one reason or another. And that is probably a little unique in this age than what it was 3 or 4 years ago. So I've seen multiple deals of that, probably, like I said, at least 3 to 5 deals where 2 weeks before closing, seller calls a broker and says, I'm not going to sell. buyer walks away. You know, now how those end up with the brokers is always a tough challenge. And obviously buyers have invested capital at that stage in the game. So, but those deals where there wasn't that trust and some of those were in that category, were tough to see disappear in the 11th hour.
So you said this is a trend that you've been seeing more recently. So this is not something that happened as much 3 to 5 years ago. If you had to play, you know, armchair psychologist, maybe therapist, what do you, I know you mentioned trust, but like, why do you think this is happening more now than it used to?
I think it's the interaction, that somebody says or does something where it's, you know, taken the wrong way or taken maliciously when it may or may not have been. And, you know, the control for these transactions sits in two camps, you know, and so they, either side can crater it at the closing table. And so I think that it is probably, sellers not being prepared to let go is one of those reasons. They haven't, there is a lot of emotion to selling a company that somebody has founded and grown for the last 20 years. And on the buy side, I think that it would be tied to something changing, or a response that they get back that didn't sit well. You know, maybe they weren't allowed to talk to a key employee, or there was something in the financials that just kind of felt funny that they couldn't put their hand on. So, those would probably be my armchair therapist commentary there.
Yeah. And you know, it's, when you think about that, like what can be done, obviously building enough trust with the seller, understanding the seller from the, you know, broker's perspective, doing their part to set the expectation with the seller of what's going to happen, what they're going to feel, and ensuring that they're ultimately ready to let go to help mitigate some of that. Obviously, you're not going to always mitigate the things that humans do, but if you can mitigate most of that, that would help. I think going back to what you said about the basically the two different camps that aren't necessarily symbiotic in their relationship, where theoretically the goal is to get a transaction done, right? Like that is the ultimate goal of all the parties involved. Yet it doesn't always go that way, where it's still adversarial. It's like, I'm selling to you, you're buying from me. And here's this thing that's, you know, it's not net win-win. And you know, where does that cause issues? And where is that the seller and just how they view business and selling things? And they've always got to win, because there's those people out there. Where is it a broker that's just not, you know, experienced enough or doesn't understand how it's being set up, or they're just hiding and obscuring the things that they hope nobody finds out in the transaction that, you know, they don't want anyone to know about, like the key employee or the lease or things like that.
Yeah. I think too is you want to find an operator that has the ability to step away and isn't dependent upon being in the company, meaning they have people, processes, procedures, those sorts of things that can operate with them having, you know, a little bit of, be it time away or not, I don't want to call it absentee, but those are better businesses and tend to transition, as opposed to the seller that does everything from HR to P&L to legal to the appraisals to bidding to the head mechanic. Those businesses are just dependent. And so, you know, and I know some good brokers out there are like, listen, we need to take this off your lap with a trusted advisor. We need to, you know, outsource your marketing because a buyer can't come in and transition into everything that you're doing.
Yeah. And if we think deeper level, which is what I'm always fascinated by, right? Like there's the unsellable, especially at a high market value of a business that's completely owner dependent, because very few buyers want to buy a job and very few lenders are going to let somebody buy a job, you know, at a high lending rate. And so there's that, but then there's also going back to sellers walking away from the closing table at the last minute, is if that's business is seller dependent, that seller's full identity is everything related to that business, which means it's a massive breakup for them mentally and emotionally to like sell the business and move on. And that's a hard one. If it's something you're doing and you've evolved yourself out and you're ready, then that's different than like everything about your being is that business and either controlling it or being involved, and you're never gonna let go of that business.
Yeah, and some sellers are more married to their business than they are to their spouse. And that scares people.
Yeah. And where like I've heard this from enough brokers too, is like one of their big qualifying things when they're going through their process of vetting a seller and taking them through their whole transactional kind of evolution towards a close from the beginning is, what does that seller have to look forward to afterwards? What are they going to? Not necessarily what are they running from? Like maybe they want to get rid of the business, they're burnt out, but like, what are they going to? Because if that going to isn't big enough, then why go to it, right? Going to is maybe golfing, maybe sitting on the beach, maybe sitting by the pool. Like that's, you're gonna pull the plug at the last minute, because why not?
Yeah, I think there is so much psychology to this that is way above my education level, you know. But I think that's why that partial buy-in might be a win-win for some people that can't fully exit and still want something to do, you know? And not to mention they get another bite of the apple when they decide they can fully divest. But, you know, that's an opinion. Too early to factually back that.
Yeah. Well, if it helps, you growing up and knowing you want to be in finance and banking and something like that, maybe closer to psychology than me. I grew up and got a degree in marine biology and tagged sharks because I wasn't really a fan of people. So like for me, this is totally odd and weird and out of place, but it's always fascinating because it's like, you know, why do people do what they do? What triggers them to do that? And then how do you help them, you know, get what they're really saying they want, but you know, there's all these underlying things. So anyway, that's probably a subject for a whole different podcast, probably hosted by somebody else. That's not me. So John, this has been amazing. For people out there, please connect with John. So it's John Wahl, W-A-H-L. You can find his email will be in the show notes. You can go to liveoak.bank is the website. That'll be in the show notes as well. You can find him on LinkedIn. Like he said, he's doing stuff online. He's always there. That's how he and I connected. And I like to interact with a lot of people online because I know they're active, they're putting things out there and they have stuff to say and share. And so, please connect with John if you're a broker, if you're a buyer, you know, just anywhere in the space. I just appreciate it because I know, John, this is a lot for you to share this. You've gone through a lot. You have a lot of experiences with ultimately the goal of just helping people, you know, transact these acquisitions and sell. So I appreciate everything that you shared and you being here today with the audience.
Absolutely. Education and knowledge is key to everyone being successful. And so, Jason, I appreciate the opportunity to be on here. Very gracious of you to spend the last hour plus with me, and thank you so much, and maybe we can do it again.
Yes, we definitely will. I feel like this is something we could do, a reoccurring thing with any SBA lender out there, because the rules change, the things change, people make different crazy decisions, so I'm sure we could have it all the time. So I appreciate you being here, and for everyone tuning in, make sure to connect with John, make sure to check out other episodes. This is on YouTube, depending on where you found it. It's on all the podcast streams. You can find it on LinkedIn. And as always, until next time, stop hoping for deals and start growing your pipeline.
Thanks for tuning in to the Business Broker Growth Show, hosted by Jason Cutter. If today's episode helped you think differently about how to build your pipeline and grow your business, share it with another broker who's ready to make the shift from hoping for listings to engineering them. Join us again for the next episode of the Business Broker Growth Show, where brokers become trusted advisors.